So this is kind of a continuation of those who were at the Jewish Ethics and Internet Conference in February, and some of you were there. So part of what we want to do is kind of more regular learning opportunities about these topics. And at the conference, we really discussed very broad issues. And now I wanted, over the course of the year, just to have some lunch and learns where we pinpoint specific issues and get to a little bit more text and a little bit more of the heart of the issues involved. This issue actually did come up at the conference. Someone asked a question about this, and it was a very good question. It wasn't really the crux of what we were talking about there. But the question came up about ethics of email. What are email ethics? And certainly today, as much as all the other forms of communication, social networking are taking hold, and I just saw this week with that Facebook for the first time had more hits than Google. Was that for the first time ever? Facebook was like this past month, I think, had more hits than any other website. So social networking is quite big, and if you look at the chart of the amount of tweets per month, it's gone the past year from like a few hundred thousand to over 5 million per month, and then that's over the past 12 months. Oh. Just the you look at this bell curve, and it's a mountain. It's not even a curve. So, but even with all of that, email is still one of the main methods of communication that the internet has provided, and still probably the most prevalent form of it. And in many ways, email has taken over a lot of other aspects in our life. Who mails a letter to anyone anymore, right? it doesn't happen. So how that affects the mail system, that's a whole question to itself. But email has a lot of different purposes, right? There's more formal emails, there's business emails, there's more private emails, there's more just quick message emails, there's forwarding. So email is such a so many ways of communicating through email. It has so many different purposes that it is a little hard to define. So the question that I want to talk about today was the expectation of privacy in emails, and also I wanted to discuss listservs, because this has come up recently to my attention as an issue. I want to discuss that as well. And the first question is, when you send an email to somebody, what is the status of that email, right? Now, while we would probably psychologically, we would say that if somebody, let's go back 15 years ago to ancient times, right? When someone mailed someone else a letter, right? So we would have a problem, or we would understand that it would be incorrect for someone to open up someone else's letter. Or if someone had a letter, someone mailed someone else a private letter, it would be inappropriate to then take that letter and show it to everybody that you know, right? We would have a certain sense that there's a certain sense of privacy in that letter. When it comes to emails, the question is, can you forward emails? When someone sends someone else an email, is it by definition public information, right? And that really gets to the internet in general. Is the internet by definition public information? Or can there still be an expectation of privacy even in the public world of the internet? Okay? Now, when it comes to email, we would think that would be the one place where that's where it would make the most sense to have a sense of privacy. I sent you a note one-to-one. And that, very often if you'll, when you get an email from an attorney, how many attorneys are here? Just so I, yeah. Okay. So when you get an email from an attorney, there's like a, there's like a 10-page, confidentiality thing in there, like just stipulating this is confidential, turning client privilege, all this kind of stuff is like, I've never actually read the whole thing. But so obviously there's a sense that they're trying to create a sense that this is a private exchange, right? Is that an accurate portrayal of what? Nope. Yeah, right. But at the same time, since it's so easy to forward emails and so easy to transfer information, abandon this sense of privacy because it's not realistic, or maybe this is a different form of communication than the letters, and therefore should have a different path. So, first, I wanted to just discuss the concept of privacy in general, and the importance of privacy in Jewish tradition, and also some of the some maybe exceptions to the right to privacy or the expectation to privacy. So I found this in an article. In the first source comes from an article in something called Contemporary. No, I forgot it already. It's a journal that comes out about 3-4 times a year. It's like Contemporary Halachic Topics. Contemporary Topics in Jewish Law. So here there's a quote from the British Parliament in 1766, which some say kind of formed the American ideology of a right to privacy. The poorest man may, in his cottage, bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, its wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, all its forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement. And the point he was trying to make is that each and every one of us have or need a sense of privacy, that whatever's going on in the world around us, we can at least have our private world on some level where the crown cannot enter, where the government cannot enter, where others cannot enter, right? We have a right to privacy. And that's, in American law, has come up in a million different issues, going as far as abortion, right? That's the most famous debate when it comes to a right to privacy. But the right to privacy is held very dear, certainly in American law and in Jewish law as well. And there's actually even Midrash that talks about that one of the things that the Syrian Greeks did in the story of Hanukkah, one of the things they did to try to break down the Jewish people is they removed the doors from everyone's home, figuring that if they couldn't have privacy, then they couldn't retain their faith, they couldn't retain their nation. That would kind of begin a breakdown of the moral structure of their society, and they could convince them in mass to just become Greek and give up their Jewishness. But that they removed their doors from their home. That's what the Midrash says. That's historically one of the things that happened. So we recognize that that's an important right. At the same time, there are times when we see in Jewish sources that even the most private moments become very public, okay? And there could be a point to that. So I'll show you here some of this tension. Source number two. This is from the Babylonian Talmud, Brachot 62a, which talks about laws of blessings. So Rabbi Akiva said, "One time I followed Rabbi Yeshua, his teacher, into the bathroom, and I learned from him three laws." Right? I'm moving into the details. But, sorry, where's that? So here we have, there are a lot of laws that pertain to going to the bathroom. A lot of aspects of Jewish law that, can you speak in the bathroom? The blessings that you say after you leave the bathroom. There's certain methods of behavior in the bathroom. And so Rabbi Akiva, though he learned the laws, he wanted to see how his teacher handled himself in that situation to learn from the experience. So he literally follows him in, right? Ben Azai said to him, "How could you have such nerve before your own teacher? How could you behave that way?" He's called to task for it, to which Rabbi Akiva responded, "It too is Torah and I must learn it." So that's story number one. That's followed by story number two, which is even more disturbing. Rav Kahana hid under the bed of his teacher, Rav, to learn from his sexual relationship with his wife. Here's Rav Kahana, he's a single guy. He's going to get married one day. And again, there's a lot of laws that pertain to one sexual relationship. How to behave, how not to behave, and there's a whole aspect of Jewish law that deals with that as well. What's considered proper behavior sexually? We'll get into that. That's a class unto itself. I'm happy to talk to anyone privately who's curious what it has to say. But he figured, he learned it, but he wants to actually see what it's like. Just like he sees his teacher, how they interact with his students, how he interacts with his family, how he interacts in a business setting. He wants to see, how else am I going to know what to do if I'm going to learn from, I might as well learn from my teacher.
He wanted a demonstration.
So when Ra found out what he had done, he scolded Rav Kahana, to which Rav Kahana responded, "It too is Torah and I must learn it." So it's interesting that here we have, in both these stories, the final word is said by the student, right? Now, what they did was might not have been the best way to do it, and certainly to do it by hiding and tricking, that's obviously not the best way to do it. But it seems there is a point here to a certain extent. Again, It's not that the Gemara condones their behavior, but it is saying that certainly someone in power, someone who has prominence, and certainly someone who is seen as a role model and a teacher, their expectation of privacy is a little bit less. Right? Because they're seen as a role model, and they don't necessarily have the right to say, you know, you don't have a right to know what I do behind the scenes. Right? And, you know, as an aside, I mean, this has been, over the past couple of years, one of the biggest issues that have come up constantly. Or what right do we know? Who cares? You know, who cares what Tiger Woods does privately? Yeah, but the flip side is he's a big sponsor, he's a role model. Yeah, but who cares? It's not our information. You know, and just go scandal after scandal. The Mark Sanford scandal, going all the way back to Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. Well, who cares? His job? Who cares? It doesn't affect his ability to do his job. Yeah, but the president is doing all these things. We have a right to know. We should know. It's important for us to know. And this debate's gone back and forth. So, not to say this settles the debate in any way, but there is a difference of an expectation of privacy once you become a public figure and once you become a role model, right? And we'll see that this certainly applies to those who are teaching children or teaching others. You lose your right to privacy if you're doing things that are inappropriate and you should be called to task for them, right? Then at that point, you lose your right to privacy, we'll see, in the most severe way. So you can't say, a person can't say, well, you know, what I do behind the scenes doesn't matter. Well, if you're teaching kids especially, then it does matter. It is relevant, right? And we'll get to that a little bit later on. At the same time, we see in source number 3 that the Talmud goes very far to make sure that a person's basic privacy is upheld. So, for example, the court messenger who is instructed to carry out a judicial decision and sees a pledge for a creditor could not enter the home of the debtor, even if they've been given permission by the court to collect money from somebody. Sometimes it was even forcibly, if the person refused to pay. If the court makes a decision, the person refuses to pay, so they're going to have to pay up, but they couldn't just barge in, right? They couldn't just overtake someone's home. There still was that process. They still respected their privacy to that extent. And here, sorry, the number's a little out of whack. The next source is the flip side. This is from Rabbeinu Yonah, who's writing in the 12th century. He wrote a book called Ashari Tshuva. And Ashari Tshuva means the gates of repentance. It's a very prominent book when it comes to... So he writes about a lot of different mitzvot in the Torah. And he focuses a lot on the process of repentance and the process of self-correction. But he discusses a lot of different issues in this book. And he writes, if you know well that a person is not truly God-fearing, and he continuously goes in a path which is not good, it is a mitzvah to speak derogatorily about him to reveal his sins and to cause people to despise sinners so that people will learn to have contempt for evil deeds. And this is part of a mitzvah, that there could be situations when it's appropriate to publicize things which are private if you know it will cause them to change, right? And sometimes when someone's misdeeds are publicized, that causes self-reflection on a grand scale. Well, let's bring back Tiger Woods. How many people have been confronted with what happened with Tiger Woods and said, whoa, wait a second, that could happen to me. Or maybe I shouldn't be doing the same thing, or I could get caught if I do that. So there are situations when it could be appropriate. Not that the first reaction is to automatically publicize what someone else is doing. You can speak to them privately, but it could be there could be situations where, you know what, if you know what Bernie Madoff is doing, you can't say he has a right to privacy and you can't be a whistleblower, right? To be a whistleblower, for example. To be a whistleblower could be the biggest mitzvah that you can do. Besides the legal issues involved, and he's, you know, certainly if they're harming other people, it's essential that someone comes out and says something and says it publicly. If you say it privately, it's not going to go anywhere.
But yeah. If this were at the level of, you know, somebody's not keeping Shabbat or Kashrut, is it a mitzvah to go out and tell people in the congregation, no, this person?
Not necessarily. It's definitely case by case, and it's certainly a situation where you think it's going to do some good. But let's say, you know, somebody is, if someone's doing something that certainly they know is wrong, and they would want to change potentially. So it could be that this comes up from time to time. Although Maimonides makes it clear that you shouldn't publicize anything certain that's between man and God. You shouldn't publicize it. In the person themselves shouldn't publicize what they're doing. So there's not an obligation to publicize that. But certainly if it's bein adam and chavero, it's interpersonal things. Someone's swindling, someone's lying, someone's constantly speaking bad about others. Right? And they're not changing, and they're really causing a lot of damage to other people. So it could be then that by publicizing it, you can call them to task and at least force them to deal with it, because on their own, they're not going to deal with it.
Yeah, so they're disqualified by
it. Yeah, there's a lot of qualifications to it. Yeah, yeah. And the next source, the Chafetz Chaim, writing about 100 years ago, and he wrote a famous book about laws of proper speech of Lashon Hara. So he writes, despite this, if one person sees in another person an ugly characteristic such as conceit or pride or some other undesirable traits, it is proper that he report this thing to his child or student to warn them not to associate with him in order that they not learn from his deed. And that this is a question of, let's say there is a role model in the community, and you see that they're doing certain things that you don't think your child should copy, right? That you don't want. So how do you handle that? How do you explain, how do you explain what's on the news when they mention Bill Clinton or Tiger Woods? And, your child's 9, 10 years old, they hear these things and they have questions and they're trying to understand, Barry Bonds takes steroids, right? Well, Barry Bonds has been our hero and now he takes steroids, but he's doing something wrong. So,
19?
What?
The kid is 19, you said?
9 or 10.
Yeah. Right? I'm saying they're young enough that they know what's going on, but they don't necessarily have the context. So, it's not, then it becomes the proper thing to do to bring that out. And those are very public issues, but in a very private way. Let's say there's a teacher in a school who's doing something that the kids are learning from, and, there's a message to be made here, so that could be appropriate. And certainly when it comes to, role models or role models in the Jewish community, we have an extra responsibility to make sure that they are fulfilling that task. Once a person makes themselves a role model, then they set themselves up to be held to a certain standard and to be held to a certain standard publicly. Once you put yourself out there publicly as a role model, and that's part of your profession, that's part of what you do, if you're a rabbi, if you're a teacher, then you it could potentially.
So there's no line there. You're saying that everything they do should be out in the public. I mean, at some point.
Not that everything they do, but if it's something that really is that really needs to change, or it makes them unfit for being a proper role model, so if there's a financial scandal, a sexual scandal, and this comes up from time to time when there's some sort of there's innuendo, there's rumors, and things are happening, and sometimes they're not dealt with quick enough because of their reputation. How will it look? It's gonna impact our community. It's gonna make people not trust our leaders anymore. And there's a lot of internal debates about these things, but we shouldn't be scared to do it, and we shouldn't be scared to have the message of our values are strong, and there are people who don't live up to them, even though they claim to, even though we thought that they did. Right, and it doesn't mean that everything is invalid just because some people.
Well, you just destroy it and you move on. Right, the same way that same way that we have companies that go bankrupt. Obviously, they're not solvent enough. We get rid of them, and someone else replaces them in their path, and supposedly we'll do a better job.
Right, but there's definitely an emotional connection here, where if someone's if you're emotionally connected to something or someone, and they've been your role model. This happened recently in the Jewish community where somebody was exposed. And I know a lot of people who were very, who looked up to them as a real role model, and it shakes you a little bit. It shakes you a lot.
I guess the question is, I assume you're referring to the situation in Israel.
Right.
And it's like, I don't know, the jury's out, maybe. I don't know, whatever happened to innocent people proven guilty. And, you send off that email, and it goes out, around the globe now, by the push of a button, and you've condemned a person who's potentially innocent. So how do you grapple with those two sort of conflicting ideologies, where on the one hand, absolutely, it's terrible when you have someone, let's say, that's molesting children or something like that in the extreme, versus how do you actually know, and there's such intense Jewish law on that, in terms of you have to give proper warning, there has to be witnesses, and all these other standards that clearly aren't being met in today's society to make that determination. So
well, in this case, yeah, I mean, in the case in Israel, I think there actually was years of warning. And yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
I'm not specifically referring to that one.
There's
so many cases in Israel recently of different things. For those of us who may not know exactly what you're referring to,
I'm referring to the case of Rabbi Matti Alon, who was a pretty prominent rabbi in Israel. And about 4 years ago, it seemed he was removed from his position working with students, and then they basically tried to, I guess, what he was, and
the same thing with the guy in New Jersey who was molesting kids, and then with the OU thing. I mean, it's just
the rabbi and the cancer predator.
It's unbelievable,
right?
I mean, he could have been like the chief rabbi of Israel.
I just don't know if you meant like the president of Israel.
Yeah.
No, it's a very prominent rabbi who could eventually have become that. Yeah. So
almost like the Pope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Makes you wonder what he's doing.
So you're right. That's definitely. So we have to be sure. Now that's a grand scale where you're going to destroy somebody. It could be a smaller scale. We have a teacher who maybe speaks a little bit too Lashon Hara, they're a good teacher, but sometimes they act that's a little too casually, or there are certain mitzvot that they're not really that careful with, and you're like, all right. These things, that's not the way we do things in our home, or something like that, right? Uh-huh. Or we think they're too strict, right? And they're too tough, or they're... Okay, for them, that's their standard, but we don't do that, something like that. It's true, but at younger ages, it's... Look, how many of us can be swept up by certain things, or, this is not the focus of my class, but that's... And the point is that that's something that can be brought up. Okay, but the main thing I want to get into is starting here at the bottom of source number 4. In the end of the 10th century, beginning of the 11th century, there was a rabbi whose name was Rabbeinu Gershom. Okay, Rabbeinu Gershom was really considered to be the first prominent rabbi in European Jewry. Jewry had been, to that point, focused more in the Middle East, and slowly but surely had moved their way into Europe. And kind of like America in the beginning, there's a community, but there aren't really any prominent scholars, and the Jewish community is kind of disheveled. And Europe is the central focus of Jewry in Ashkenazi Jewry. So Ashkenazi Jewry now makes their way to Europe, which becomes Ashkenazi Jewry because Ashkenaz is Europe. So they make their way into Germany, into France, and Rabbeinu Gershom is really the first major public figure, major public rabbi, and he introduced a series of takanot, which were like decrees for the people, and partly they were to adjust to this new society that they were living in, and partly were to cement certain things that had already become common practice. So, for example, his most famous ban is on polygamy, right? That Ashkenazi Jews would no longer practice polygamy, something they hadn't really done for a while anyway, but it kind of cemented it, something that Sephardi Jews do not accept upon themselves. In the land of Israel they have, but that was not really common practice up to 60 years ago. One of his decrees is, and it's quoted here by the response of the Maharam of Rutenberg, another prominent rabbi a few generations later, a ban was issued not to look at a letter of one's friend that was sent to another friend without his knowledge. If it was thrown into the trash, it is permitted. And this we'll get into. But here we have this takana, this decree, not to read someone else's letter. Okay, and this becomes the basis of the discussion about forwarding emails and the laws of privacy about emails. Now, there's a few different reasons given as to why this takana was introduced. So here's source number 5 on the bottom. The Halachos Ketanos 12 is of the opinion that the reason for the cherem is that you were excommunicated if you broke these rules, right? That's the way it was structured. You were considered you were excommunicated from the Jewish community. The reason for this cherem of not reading someone else's letter is because one should not come to reveal gossip or a secret which falls under the halachos, the laws of rechilos, which means gossiping. And by reading someone else's letter, one is revealing the secret to oneself. Okay, so that was one answer given, that they're trying to prevent too much gossiping, too much information spreading, and now you have letters, and you have letters being sent all over the country, all over the continent. And if the messengers were reading the letters, or people got hold of these letters, This is pre-email and pre-phone calls. You had a lot of very sensitive information going very long distances. And if that some things became public information, you might say, well, look, they gave me this letter. You know, I'm holding it. They trusted it. So I can read it. What's the big deal? So you're not allowed to read it, even if there's nothing incriminating in the letter, even if there's nothing that's even negative necessarily or would speak bad about either party, you don't have a right to that information. Okay? That was one answer, one reason given. Another answer given to us, Chaim says, the reason why one may not read someone else's letter is because doing so is considered borrowing something which is not yours. I.e. the letter or the information, one is considered a ganav, is considered theft. It's theft of information. It's theft of knowledge. And theft of knowledge and information is also considered theft. So that's another reason given. Others say the cherim, the ban, maybe because of the pasuk, the verse in the Torah, of yahat larecha kamocha, to love someone else like yourself, which means that something you would not want done to yourself, you should not do to others. That mitzvah already existed. But when it's cemented is that clearly, we would not want other people reading our mail. And if we sent someone a private letter, we would not want someone outside to read it. So this was clearly defined. One of the definitions of loving someone else as yourself is if you someone sends a letter and you have access to it, you don't read it.
No, Robert, I mean, this struck me as just like perplexing when you started out at the beginning, the expectation of privacy. So I mean, obviously we've been on Gershom, his takana. Prior to that, people didn't have that expectation for some strange reason. You know what I mean? Is that the case? Was this like everyone around the country was reading everyone's mail or something? Like, no. The same thing with the wives. I mean, so he came along and said, hey, okay, you can't marry, lots of women over here.
That's a good question. It's not clear if this had become some sort of rampant problem or if that now the stakes were higher and he wanted to make sure this was clear. I mean, it's one thing to say, you don't do it. It's nothing to say, if you were caught doing this, you would be excommunicated from our community. Our community can't function if we don't trust each other. Our community can't function if private information is being shared and being stolen. So it could be he was just upping the ante to prevent this because he realized this was going to be a serious issue. Now you had a lot more people, they had certain professions in the Middle East, and now people were becoming merchants much more commonly. And they were traveling long distances, and they were keeping in touch with family, and they were keeping in touch with their properties and occupations in different parts of the world. And letter writing was becoming a much bigger issue. And some of this very sensitive information was being passed long distances. These guys would be traveling for a year and a half. Their wife did have a baby. Someone could die. Something could have been stolen. I mean, all sorts of things can happen. And it was considered essential that in order to keep this community together, that this had to be reinforced. That's another way of looking at it.
It's like a short-selling rule of financial exchanges. You would know it's bad, but unless it's strictly prohibited, people kind of...
Right. Now, again, because a lot of these things are already in the Torah,
exactly.
Meaning, it's already in the Torah, so why do we need this ban? Because we want to make sure that this is clear, right? Mm-hmm. And look, think about it. How easy is it to justify forwarding an email, a private email to somebody else? Right? It's almost like nothing, right? People do it all the time. Unless you really have in your mind, this is a terrible thing, it's a very easy thing to justify to yourself. Right? So, if we take this as a given, then this really opens up the discussion to email as well. If there's an expectation of privacy in the message that is sent, then that privacy has to be kept.
And Robbie, you keep mentioning this, you started out with this whole expectation. Does expectation really matter? At the end of the day, who cares about your expectation, whether it was, you could have been completely insane. It's sort of like, under American jurisprudence, we very much look at an objective standard when we relate to certain matters of law. It doesn't matter subjectively if this, person, he was, had a weak skull, and so, he died because you touched him on the head. Objectively, the expectation was reasonable that most people, if you would have touched him on the head, he would have been fine, type of thing. So,
okay.
Does the Torah care about expectation?
Meaning, if you demonstrate that you expect this to be private, then you have a right for that to be. Meaning, let's say you do a public letter, right?
Sure.
Then you've lost that expectation of privacy. Once you do an open letter,
maybe you've put it on a listserv or something.
So we'll get to listservs, because listservs are complicated, because there's some that are more private and some that are more public.
So you have a Facebook page that's set for no public, no private settings.
Right. But let's say you have a Facebook page that has private settings, but you have 2,000 people who see it every day.
Right.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, does it sort of break, you know, I don't know, Jewish law, if you above 10, if there's like a million, then it's not considered private anymore, it's public.
Right, so I
it's a speech speaks of three people. Right.
So that's when it comes to when it comes to Lashon Hara, once certain information has become public, then it's no longer Lashon Hara, right? Meaning, it's not Lashon Hara to say Bill Clinton had an affair with Monica Lewinsky, right? It's already public information. Not that I should say, not that that's how I should spend my day discussing these things, but it's known already. It's already public information. Once something is public information, it ceases to become Lashon Hara to a certain extent.
Though, or
so, yeah, so it still could be unnecessary, it could be gossiping, it could be all sorts of other things. But it does remove some aspects of Lashon Hara when it becomes that public. So when it comes to a Facebook page of 2,000 of your closest friends are getting this information, right, half of which you can't remember how you met them, so you could very much argue that you've at that point, then you've demonstrated you don't expect privacy, right? You know, obviously Twitter is public by definition, but even if you have some privacy accounts on Facebook, it's hard to argue that you have an expectation, as opposed to a private message on Facebook or a private message on Twitter, where then you really are expecting a certain level of privacy. That's why you're sending it more privately. Listservs are very complicated, and we'll get to that, because some listservs are public, and some listservs are password protected, only for certain professions, for certain companies, for certain, you know, look, we have rabbinic listservs. And, you know, if you're a member of this particular rabbinic organization, you can be on the listserv. And actually, just recently, there was a whole big thing that somebody cut and pasted what some rabbi had written on the listserv and sent it to other people outside of the group. And it was, I mean, there was a big uproar about it. It was very, you know, he was writing in his mind, thinking of staying within this group. Now, again, there's 500 rabbis in this group. He knows, you know, maybe he knows 10% in most of them, you know. So is it fair to expect privacy in that kind of circumstance? Or, you know, let's say instead of forwarding it, someone just repeated what was said to a colleague of theirs who wasn't on the listserv. So that it's a real gray area. The more private something is, the greater sense that a person legitimately has that this should be kept private.
So if you have an email 101, and in your email you say, please do not forward.
Certainly if you say, please do not forward.
So all of a sudden, right, then you have an email that doesn't have please do not forward, and then you have a, whatever the gradations are from going back from that.
Right, well, so let's get to the sources, because we'll get to that, right. Yeah. I mean, do you have to write please do not forward, or is it implied please do not forward?
That's I write now please do not forward and things that I really don't want forward because I assume that people bring to
this. Is that just in your trailer type of thing? Or like, you know, literally each time you send up an email, you'll
I think it's important, just like I will sign as a lawyer, right, privileged and confidential.
If but isn't that just sort of automatically in your trailer, you know what I mean, at the bottom?
I work at a company, not at a law firm.
I mean, but I have it in my email. I mean, it's just, you know, a long disclaimer on the bottom saying this is confidential, don't forward. I mean, obviously, not that I care with most of my emails, the intent is to forward. Or, you know what I mean, right. Potentially. But I mean, I think technically I haven't even read it, but I mean, it says something in there like, you know, don't distribute, it's confidential, blah, 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 blah. You're
right,
subject
so
to death.
Things that you really don't want to forward, sometimes you specifically say, at least I did, in the subject line or in the beginning of the email.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can do it. The question if you don't do that, is it against her law to forward that email? So we'll get to that. Okay. Okay. The next one we kind of got to already, source number 6. But here, the Rashba, who's also one of the more prominent rabbis of the Middle Ages, so here, Rabbeinu Gershom did not make his decree so that people might violate Torah or rabbinic halacha because of them. Just the opposite, they were instituted only to ensure compliance with our Torah and to ensure that Jewish people would act in a correct and modest manner. Therefore, if a Beit Din, parents or educators objectively determine that in a certain situation they can only ensure compliance with our Torah by violating the privacy of an individual, by reading their mail, diary, or listening in their phone conversations. This is a summary, obviously, that Rashba didn't write about phone conversations. And years ago, there's no doubt that Rabbeinu Gershom would agree that it would be a mitzvah to do so. And this comes up with children and using the internet. Is it a violation of privacy to read your kids' emails, right? To check on their Facebook pages. So if there's real concern that they're going to get themselves into trouble, or that as a parent you have a certain right to try to enforce certain standards in your home, so then that would not be considered breaking Jewish law. That you could potentially do that. You have to be careful, but that would seem to be okay. I mean, it's certainly fair to say, okay, you can have a 14-year-old can have an email account, but I have access to everything. I'm going to read everything, right? That's a fair thing. That's not considered a violation of privacy. But also in situations where you think there really might be something, and this implied back then, if someone was rumored to be an assassin and they're getting mail, right? The Beit Din could seize the letter. And say, okay, we have to read this first. We don't know what's going on here, but there's rumors here. We have to protect someone's life. So the point is that this ban was not all encompassing. It didn't protect everyone in every circumstance. And this has come up in American law. We've had circumstances where people claim right to privacy when they were caught doing illegal acts. I was reading about something that happened, I think, in the 70s also about. There was some sort of doctor who was like pretending to be some sort of expert or had some sort of special powers, and then Time magazine and a major newspaper or magazine did an undercover story on them and exposed them, and this doctor sued them because of right to privacy, and he was convicted and he won the case. So in that kind of circumstance, if there really was real concerns, then the Beit Din can certainly seize a letter, but that the person might lose their privacy at that point.
All right, neighbors.
Sorry. Okay. A few other points.
You really want to hear the lecture of it.
I'm very popular with dogs.
I think it might be the chicken.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, Rabbi, is it okay, though, halakhically, if like an employer or a parent just says, hey, have zero expectation of privacy, have a nice day? I'm not saying I will look at everything, but I can, and that's the deal here. And if you say that as a parent, if you say that as an employer, does that, under Jewish law, cover you in a sense?
I would think so. I think if it's upfront going in, I mean, the employer certainly is a good question. Your emails are not, your work emails are not, are public information, or at least are subject to review by your the person who's above you. I would think that's fair. I would think that could work.
What if they don't say? I guess more like parents.
That's a bad idea. It's hard to say it's against Jewish law. If they're really concerned, right? If they're just like curious, if they're just being curious, if they really have a concern about something, then from Jewish law they could do it. But I wouldn't suggest doing it that way.
Out of curiosity, where does the age, what's the age of the child? Is it up to 13? Is it up to 17, 18?
That's a good question. I mean, when do they gain their own privacy? Is right. Bar by mitzvah age now
appropriate? Or
as a parent, my instinct is to say, as long as you're living under my roof, but obviously, if they're like in college and they're still living under your roof, it's going to be different. Certainly before bar by mitzvah age. I think in today's society, definitely through high school. I think it's fair. I mean, it's going to get more complicated and it's going to be more difficult, but,
Going back to the previous source, number 5, on the Halachas Katanas, which reason do you think is the most important for keeping privacy?
It's not out of what I keep. The question was, why was this ban made in the first place? That's what these points are addressing. that wouldn't, it's not an issue of what I think is the most important. I'm just presenting historically why what the reasons are given as to why this was done initially. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to. And let's get to a few more that I think are important. Number 9, I think, is very important, and this is what we're talking about. If the owner of the letter throws it out in the garbage, then it can be read by others. If he finds an open letter unattended and written on it is the Cherem Rabbeinu Gershon applies to this letter, he cannot read it. And this is interesting historically, because it's kind of like you're saying, do not forward. So people used to write in their letters, this letter is subject to the ban of Rabbeinu Gershon. That's what people would write. They had an acronym for this. And they would write this on the letter so people would know, like, I expect privacy. And they would actually would write that. And therefore, even if the letter was open...
What was the acronym?
I have it somewhere. It was like an 8-letter, 9-letter acronym that, like... that. But yeah, it became known that that's what it was.
Yeah.
So let's say, you have a desk, right? You work in an office and there's people all around and you have a letter in your desk, if certainly if that was on top, that was a message, you're prohibited from reading this. And if you happen to find it or someone stole it or ended up somewhere, let's say someone sent the fax and there's, a public fax machine, but, the whole office shares one or two fax machines and you don't say I want people reading it. So that was one of the ways that was done. Now, so therefore, even if a letter was thrown out or was found in a public place, if it was written on there, the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershon applies to this letter, that was a message not to read the letter, and it was prohibited to do so. However, if the person if the owner throws it away, then it can be read by others. But it's a little complicated because there are many who say, we'll see here, source number 10, when the poskim, when the deciders of Jewish law say if a letter is thrown in the garbage is permitted to read it, is referring to an open place where one can tell the one who threw it there does not care if anyone reads it. However, when a letter is sent by someone else, then even if it is thrown in the garbage by the recipient, one should still not read it, since it can be assumed that the sender would mind if the letter was read, even if it was thrown away. In addition, when one throws a letter in a garbage can, i.e. in their house, it still could be that he does not want others to read the letter. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, if one rips the letter, he is showing that he is mocking, that he is careful the letter not be read by others. So it's not an all-encompassing answer to say, the letter was thrown out, because if I send the letter to somebody else, I lose control of that information, and it can be reasonable to assume that the person sending the letter doesn't want it to be read by others. And that's really what happens with emails. One person sends it, the other one receives it. Now the one who received the email has all the power, right? Now they control what happens from this point forward. The assumption is the one who sent it might not want it to be forwarded on, but they now don't have say anymore. So that's really why the Cherem is so important, because it gives power, some sense of control back to the person who sent it. So there's a sense of confidentiality. It would be fascinating to see if someone wrote on emails forwarding this email subject to the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom or something. I didn't mention this earlier, but it's interesting. This is one ban that was accepted by the Sephardic community equally to the Ashkenazi community. They didn't accept polygamy, but they did accept this. So this became really very early. The entire Jewish people accepted this upon themselves as being
probably a lot less painful than polygamy. I'll go with the letter thing.
The letter thing sounds good.
Not a big deal.
Now here, number 11 is interesting. One is permitted to read letters which are sent open without an envelope, such as a postcard. When you send a postcard, the mailman can read it, right? When you send a postcard, it's by definition more open. When you think of a letter as being sealed or private, so then that really was the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. You can't open a sealed letter, right? Now, in our time, email is not quite sealed, but it is to a certain extent. And if you borrow someone's laptop and you go into Google and you see that they're already signed into their email account, right? So that's not an open letter. It's password protected. Okay, you have access to it, but reading is certainly prohibited. But an open letter, or a letter sent, that's considered to be a public, that's considered to be public at that point. And this is where the listservs are an interesting question, because listservs are kind of like a postcard. I'm trying to I'm trying to find the best ways to compare very different types of things. But listservs are pretty public, right? A postcard's not going to be read by the whole world, but it's a pretty open letter. And certainly as a matter of common, you know, of it's a good idea to think of the internet as a public place, even though you might think you have a sense of privacy. Anything you say has a permanence and a publicity. So email definitely has a sense of privacy. And I think, it, you know, Sarah Scheinberg, you know, said, another prominent Israeli halachic decider, said that certainly email has the same rules as a letter, a sealed letter. A listserv is much more complicated because once it's somewhat public, it's almost all the way public. It really falls somewhere in between these two situations. But I definitely wouldn't say there's definitely no sense of privacy, and certainly would be inappropriate to forward that on just to other people. But it's hard to say it's like a sealed letter if you post something on a listserv.
Wouldn't you think that the password protection would correspond to sealed, not sealed ban?
Yeah, I mean, I hear that. There's
if you have to log into this list server, and it's access, let's say, restricted by a certain administrator or at least a group, then you are commuting within, I guess, the community still. So.
No, that's why it falls somewhere in between, because there's a certain level of privacy to it.
Right.
But if you send something out to 2,000 people, now how big is a listserv? Let's say it's 5 people. You know, let's say it's a family listserv, right? You have a family listserv or something, and there's 5 or 6 people on it. That's more of a sense of privacy. How sensitive is the information? Sometimes the listserv, by definition, has more sensitive information.
Mm-hmm.
That should not be shared. I don't know. There's like a listserv for a psychologist to share information or ask questions about cases that they have. You think that's pretty confidential information. It has to remain private. I don't know. It falls somewhere in between. I haven't asked a posting. I'm curious what some of them would say on this issue. But I'm definitely going to ask them today or tomorrow because I'm curious what they have to say. It's certainly incorrect and probably breaking halacha to forward that information. But does it fall under the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom technically? I don't know. I could argue it doesn't fall under that ban, but you're still gossiping and you know, it can be very harmful to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But is there an expectation of privacy on the listserv? I don't know. I've written on some of these listservs, and I don't know. I'm extremely careful. Like I assume anything I write could go anywhere. I mean, it shouldn't be forwarded. But yeah, in the back of your mind, you have to know that it could be. Now, that's the way I look at it. What do you say, Bruce?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, just like from a work perspective, I mean, I take on the attitude that every email I send out is basically going to be distributed, you know, without my control. And so there are a lot of things that I just will not put into an email. I'll make a phone call on truly sensitive information that I don't want getting back. You know, I mean, I think it's even interesting, like, you know, just a practical example, you know, we have a company that we're going to invest money into. We brought it to another investor. The other investor then had the meeting, gave me some feedback, you know, and they're still deciding, you know, is it okay for me to share that, forward that email, for example, with the entrepreneur? Say, hey, here's some feedback from them. Why don't you put together some answers, and then we'll respond to that person. You know, I don't really feel comfortable doing that. You know, I'd rather sort of pick up the phone and say, hey, here are the bullet points of kind of, you know, here are the issues. You know, why don't you respond to me and I'll forward it on, just because I it's a question of what's the expectation of privacy, I guess, from the venture guy that sent it to me. I don't know. I mean, typically they send it to the entrepreneur anyway. That same, you know, maybe they'll frame it a little bit differently.
Right.
And I often find people forward emails and they don't even see a lot of the threads. You forget, you know, a lot of the history. And a lot of that was also very confidential and sensitive stuff that people just, forgot there was a whole list of things where you're just, you know what I mean, you're just rushing. And then we saw it actually with, like, our kids in school and some rabbis were involved as well. I think, like, it's really dangerous. Email's really dangerous because people don't appreciate you hit that button and it's out there for good. And you really can't, like, and I just had this conversation yesterday with another guy who sent me an email where, you know, I thought from the email he was mad. You know what I mean? Like, it seemed like he was very angry. But then when I picked up the phone and spoke to him, you know, not at all. He was totally fine. It was just, you know, you can't really...
Because we interpret the tone of the email.
Yeah.
And if we're thinking a certain way, or we're nervous about something, and, you know, it can throw us off. It happens all the time. And that's why, you know, it's tough, because email is extremely dangerous in that sense.
Yeah.
We rely on it. I mean, you can't call people anymore. There's some people you can't call, or they'll just say, email me, or, you know, it's impossible to get them on the phone, but you send an email, you know you get a response within the hour. Or if it's international, so, like, you know, it's you know, so in some ways, so much of what we do is it really relies on email nowadays. But you have to, you know, our writing skills have to be so much better, because now we have to try to, we have to put tone into the email. We have to put it in as much as we can. I mean, there are ways of doing it, but so often email is quick and terse, and we're just relaying information. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, yeah. So it can be prohibited to do something for other people to do something, but sometimes you have to be smart about it. But it's tough, because some of the nice things that the internet offers, it offers the ability for people to connect, it offers people to communicate, to bring together groups. That's why the listserv is a big deal, because, you know, it allows people to discuss things with professionals like themselves who otherwise wouldn't have access, they wouldn't have access to. And rabbis, it's great, because we're all scattered everywhere, and issues come up, and we really want to hear what other people have to say about these issues. But the bigger that group gets, the less control you have over it. So, you know, I have different listservs. Some are like very small groups that are like pretty homogenous, and some are just these big, massive groups that I only know a small percentage of the people personally. And, you know, so it changed the dynamic of it.
So net, though, under Jewish law, is it really a function of a person's expectation, number one, and then number two, or, you know, a reasonable expectation, number one, and then number two, to the extent that they explicitly say, do not forward, do not share, then that's that expectation. And outside of that, then basically it's not considered private.
If you have a fair expectation of privacy, then the ban of rabbinic gersha would seem to apply. Even if it's not 100% private, but you make it clear. Let's say you send an email and you CC two other people on it, right? Is it public now? Or is that still private? But, like, what's the point when... So certainly then, if you'd write, you know, do not forward, I expect this not to be forwarded. Yeah. So then that's okay. I mean, a letter, you know, you can write a letter and it wasn't something meant for only one person to see it.
Yeah.
But once it becomes more public, or it's posted in a way that's public, at a certain point you're going to lose a certain sense of privacy. But how about this case? Let's say you post something anonymously on a website, or as a comment on a website. Is it fair to expect privacy if someone realizes that that's you? They could tell, you know, some clue gives it away, right? You have an anonymous blog, and someone, you know, figures out who you are. Is that a fair expectation of privacy, because you've been trying to be anonymous? But as a public forum, by definition, it's a public forum. So that might be an that might not be a fair expectation. Remember, you tried to pull it off, you didn't do it, but okay, in this life.
I think you probably also lean back on the anonymous donations, where people, you know, even though some people know who the donation is coming from, the expectation is still that donation will remain very private and anonymous, essentially.
Seeing someone requests donation.
Right. Somebody makes a donation and requests to be not named, to remain anonymous.
Right.
That's probably similar to having an anonymous website or a blog where you request in honor of remaining anonymous. So you'd expect people who even, you know, might have figured out that you were the one who made it an issue.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. But even that, I mean, you know, someone might figure it out or find out.
Again, from the Torah, from